The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the board, staff, underwriters, and donors of Voice of Vashon.
Live from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And I'll tell you, the ocean is rocking and rolling today. We're going from side to side, and we haven't seen dry land since we left, actually, Barcelona, Spain, a couple stops right over there. But it's been over a week since we've seen dry land. And we have two more days before we get into Grand Bahamas. Then we finish up in Orlando. And I'll be back with you folks live in beautiful downtown Vashon next Tuesday. So I hope to see you all listening from then. And, you know, one of the things I love most about travel is the interesting people that I meet from all over the world, all different walks of life. And I happen to be on the ship, just getting on the ship, the first part of this journey, and I noticed this woman had, well, not only did she have pink hair, but she also had a lanyard with some sunflowers on it. And we're going to explain to you at the end of the show what that sunflower means and how you should pay particularly close attention when you see somebody displaying a sunflower. But the person I started talking to was fascinating. She's had an incredible life, and she also happens to be from
Manchester, UK.
Ladies and gentlemen, Lynn Robinson. She's going to share her experience, strength, and hope about she's not an addict, she's not an alcoholic, but I'll tell you what, she survived living with one, and she came out glowing, and she's going to tell you her story. Here's Lynn Robinson.
Thanks, Tom. Hi there, everybody. It feels really strange talking to a mobile phone in the middle of nowhere. I hope you can understand my accent. I don't sound like the Queen, and I don't sound like anybody from Harry Potter. So I'll give you a quick background of who I am. My name's Lynn. I'm 58. I've got two fantastic boys that are in the British Army and five wonderful grandchildren. I'm a retired theatre manager, which means I worked in the OR, doing anaesthetics and recovery, which means I put people to sleep and used to wake them up again. So, one of my little tricks was that I'd get them to sing a song when they were going to sleep, and then when they woke up, they'd still be singing the same song. So it does actually work. So, my journey. Oh, what an up and down of a life I've had. My second marriage, the first marriage finished because I'd been married to him 18 years and he got one of my friends pregnant. So that was the end of that. And out of the frying pan into the fire, so to speak. I don't know whether or not that's an American saying or not. Is it? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I quickly met my second husband, called Dave. And he was an IT expert. He came to fix my computer. And we got chatting and we met up and met up and met up. And then we eventually started dating. Really nice guy, a couple of years younger than me. But both my boys were, well, Joshua was, Josh was the eldest. He was in his mid-teens, and George was only young. He was only at elementary school. We call it primary school in the UK. So I had joint custody with the two boys, and I moved into Dave's house, which was really happy until his dad died about a year into the relationship. And when his dad died, he spiraled out of control, and this spiraling happened so quickly. I didn't know what on earth to expect. I didn't know how to act towards this. I thought, oh, I'm a woman of the world, I can deal with this. But when push came to shove, alcohol was always going to win. And it did on many occasions for many years. He did a lot of work from home, but then I realised that he wasn't working from home. He was just getting more and more drunk. I was coming home from doing a 12-hour shift in a very high-impact job, to coming home to a husband that had not even peeled the potatoes for our evening meal. So he was there. He used to fall asleep. He used to wet himself. I used to have to clean him up. He had something called Crohn's disease, which is a digestive problem, which he used to mess himself, and I used to have to wash him down. And he wouldn't remember me doing all these things because I loved him. He didn't remember me doing things. I was the woman that had tell him the truth once he woke up. But he was never sober from when his dad died. It got worse and worse and worse. He'd go to bed with vodka and coke, and he'd wake up with vodka and coke. And by this point, Joshua, my eldest, had joined the army, the British Army, and he was doing his basic training. So George was at home, and he used to say to George, don't touch my coke, it's special coke, don't touch it. But it's only because it was laced with vodka. He used to drink himself sober by drinking cider in between the vodka and the wine. And when he drank himself sober, when he was on the cider, it was a lot nicer than when he was on the hard stuff. But he used to go through three-litre bottles of cider per day, plus a litre of vodka a day, and maybe a couple of bottles of wine as well. So he was a heavy drinker. But while he was not working, he'd turn around and say, oh, work's dried up, I've been made redundant, can you help me out? So I ended up taking out a mortgage, and he eventually, well, he wiped me out for £32,000, which I don't know how much it is in dollars, but it was a lot, and it took me a long time to pay off, even when the relationship finished. Also, while I was at work, I didn't realise that I wasn't allowed into his office, and that the office was a little drugs den. So he'd be on whatever he could get hold of. And he used to do IT jobs for what we would call gangster type of guys. So he'd wipe CCTV, he'd do false letterheads for people, and he'd get a backhand of cocaine or speed or whatever he could really get hold of. But I didn't know he was actually on the stuff. I just thought, because he'd been asleep all day, he'd be awake all night. But it went worse and worse and worse. So, under my misjudgment, he gave me the option, either I married him or I should walk away. And thinking that I got a child that was under his roof, I couldn't walk away because I'd end up in a homeless shelter, which I couldn't let George do that. So I thought, I'm going to fight this. So we got married, and we got married in June 2011. We'd been together a few years at this point, and looking back, it was the worst thing I could have done to my son, to put him through what he saw that he shouldn't have been able to see. He was about 9 or 10 years old at this point. So let's wind things forward a little bit. In December 2012, 2012. My dad died on Boxing Day, and Boxing Day is the day after Christmas Day. Both parents were elderly, and my mum had dementia. Mum and dad had been married for 60-odd years, and my dad, the proudest thing that I can say is he was a church organist for 75 years and met the Queen once, who gave him some a recognition of his service towards the church. So anyway, dad died. Wasn't happy about him dying. He was my rock. And the day, I don't know whether or not in the US we have funerals where we cremate the bodies, and then with the ashes of the bodies we bury them in a garden of remembrance. And the day that we were supposed to bury my dad's ashes was the day that one of the most traumatic events of my life happened. We didn't bury the ashes because the ground was frozen. It was in January. And the priest said, no, we'll have to do it a different date. But Dave wanted to come to the actual interment of the ashes. And I told him he wasn't allowed to because he was absolutely stinking drunk. And I said, no, I don't want my family to be embarrassed about this. This is my day with my family. So Dave then, there was a bit of a bit of violence that went on. And Dave said, right then, go to your, I won't swear, go to the funeral. So I didn't know, because I knew by this point that the ashes weren't going to be buried. So I went straight to the police, because what he'd done in his wonderful thought processes was fire a gun around a photograph of me in the bedroom, and there were four gunshots round a photograph of me, and I'd actually said to him, what on earth are you doing? And he said, that's target practice for your head. Get out of my house. So that's what I did. I went to the police, and he thought I was going to church. So, of course, I went to the police and said, my husband's just threatened to blow my head off. And the police were very understanding. I'd never done anything like this before in my life. And, of course, he was quite happy being drunk in on his sofa and thinking, oh, she's away for a few hours yet. But, yes, I was away for a few hours, but I was only down the road in the police station. So, because it was a firearms offence, in the UK, we do not have guns. We do not have a gun policy as such. We don't have, I don't know whether or not in your state it's a gun-friendly state or not, but in the UK, you've got to have a special licence. And he hadn't got this special licence. And he'd got two guns that were his dad's guns that he'd inherited because his dad was a gun collector. So one was a Smith & Wesson. I don't know much about them, but there were two shotguns. And so the firearms people from the police got involved. And we had something called the Tactical Aid Unit, which was a negotiator and a group of men that had balaclavas on and bulletproof vests and guns. And they had to plan how to get my ex-husband out of the house without him shooting himself because it was a firearms offence. And so, of course, I had to draw photographs of which way the doors opened and how many stairs there were to go upstairs because it was a three-story building. And the negotiator came and talked to me, and the police team came to talk to me as well. And so they then went in their big vans that were big bulletproof vans down to where I lived. And, of course, all the neighbours were having a right good look out of the window thinking, oh, is there something interesting happening at the end of the street? And it was that he had no idea that the policemen were out there. And the policemen told all the neighbours to get away from the windows just in case there were shots fired. So, right. So what we did was the police, as eventually arrested him when we'd had the police helicopter came round, and it said one man for police custody on the walkie-talkie. So I had to go to court and testify against him. At this point, my mum was dying, and within 6 months, I had Dad die. I had my this trauma of my marriage breaking down and my mum dying. And having to go to court and testify against a man that pleaded not guilty when he was obviously guilty. Anyway, he got 10 years in prison. So I had to rebuild my life then. And it was really hard with a young lad and a young lad that was in the army. And it was hard because I was diagnosed with PTSD, complex PTSD. And so I had to have a lot of different therapies. I had something called EMDR, which I couldn't do because in the meantime, I came down with sepsis and my balance was affected. So I had to have CBT, EMDR, talking therapies, medical therapies, psychiatric appointments, and I got badly triggered with a lot of different things. So it was very hard to pull myself into position. But thankfully, I'm on the other side of it now. But in the meantime, I went from being independent mum with a good job. I lost my job because I had sepsis and it affected my balance and coordination. So I'd not just lost my husband and my livelihood, I'd lost everything. Which I felt. So I then did a stupid thing and took an intentional overdose. George was on holiday with his dad and I was very close to death. I think it was one of the neighbours that called for me, for the ambulance to come and take me to the hospital. And so I was in hospital for a very long time because we had to got my head out. So it was called a voluntary section, which you don't get forced into it by the doctors. You choose to go in for help. So I picked up, I shook myself down, and now, with the help of the doctors and with the help of my friends and family, I'm a different woman. I have a little job looking after houses and cats and dogs and alpacas and pigs and sheep and ducks and it's fantastic. And I come on these cruises and meet really good people like Tom. So, yes, that's my story. And I hope that I've turned the other way. I've done some fantastic things since I've rebuilt my life. And, oh, yes, these little sunflowers that we were on about. I have a lanyard, a sunflower lanyard. And it means a hidden disability. And my hidden disability is because I had sepsis, my balance is bad. So I walk like I'm drunk, even though I hardly ever touch the drop. So if anybody sees, it's a green lanyard with little yellow sunflowers on. If you ever see it, think, oh, that person's got invisible disabilities. And just take a little bit of consideration when you see them. Okay, I'm going to pass you on to Tom now. Nice talking to you. Bye-bye.
Ta-ta. I think we need to go have a spotted tea. Anyway, so her sepsis makes her balance off, which is perfect for today because nobody has their balance on this ship right now. It's rocking back and forth that bad. So, folks, it's been great being with you. Thanks again to Truman O'Brien for engineering this show today. And I look forward to being back in beautiful downtown Vashon next week with a couple of live guests talking to you about the new movie that's going to be at the theater. And those, again, are free movies from VYFS and free popcorn, free candy, free sodas, and followed by free pizza and discussion. Thank you, everyone. Keep spreading the love. Talk to you soon.